I saw this real relic from the 90s past in the Walgreens parking lot just the other day. Really something that I have not seen since maybe high school, maybe earlier than that. It was this, the club. You remember the club? It's this thing. It's like this bar that you put on your steering wheel. You put it on your steering wheel and you extend it from the center. It's got this extendable arm that ratchets and locks. And locks your steering wheel in place so that car thieves get into your car and they may be able to hotwire the car. They may be able to jimmy it to get it to start, whatever they do, but they cannot steer it. It locks the steering wheel, so they're just, you know, completely surprised. And they really weren't supposed to get that far because the idea of the club is that it's very visible. It's a security feature in plain sight so that it's supposed to stop the thief cold in his tracks. When he sees the club on your steering wheel, then he just goes on to the other car. He just like shrugs his shoulders and mopes Charlie Brown style until he finds, you know, the car that does not have the club. And these were very ubiquitous security features that were sold on television infomercials. I guess you had to like call in. You had to call an 800 number to get them sent to you. Or I suppose maybe they also sold them in the mall at like those As Seen on TV stores, those kiosks that were in the middle of the mall right between the carts that, you know, like sold perfume, or the people were always assaulting you with perfume samples, and the guy who sold those Jesus t-shirts, you know, with the popular logos like Coca-Cola and Reese's, but they changed the names to the brands to resemble Jesus sayings and slogans and things like that. Yeah, this was the club. And they even colored it bright red. The general model was that it was like colored bright red so that even in the dead of night, the car thief would see it. And just, they didn't even have to see the rest of the club. They just had to see that big red stripe as, going across your steering wheel. And just, again, mope their shoulders and move on. And, it was just a very common feature, like, especially in the 90s. I think it was It was invented by the security company of some kind in like the late 80s, and just had this very quick marketing push. And so it was just very, very ubiquitous for a time. And I even remember in the movie Swingers, you know, that movie with Swingers, that movie that came out in the middle of that very narrow window in the mid 90s. That return of like the Zoot Suit and you know, the big band, the ska kind of movement, I suppose, you know, the Cherry Poppin' Daddies and the Squirrel Nut Zippers and the Mighty Mighty Bosstones, although I think they were more ska, not so much a big band. But yeah, that movie Swingers that came out in the 90s, there was a scene where one of the characters was walking Heather Graham to her car, and Heather Graham gets in her car and she struggles to unlock the club because they're in the middle of this like romantic moment, and the moment is like stepped on a little bit because it's just very clumsy to get that thing you got to put the key in the center and then unlock it and then negotiate it out of the steering wheel and then put it up. And I think it probably made more or less like a better weapon against thieves, like a better blunt object, like a brute force weapon that you could use against thieves, kind of like a tire iron to fight them, than it actually did like a preventative security measure, right? Because really what it was just like all visible security devices. Just once a thief sees it, all they've got to do is just know one simple trick to to get rid of it. And what happened with the club was that it made the business of stealing a car much easier, because all they would have to bring with them was like a little bit of a little bitty hacksaw that they could fit and conceal inside their sleeves, and then they could just get in the car. And I think in like three or four pushes back and forth against the steering wheel column, they could essentially like just like, you know, saw above the club and then like lift the club up and then just get it off. And so, you know, the steering wheel may need to be replaced, but nevertheless, like, your car is gone. They figured it out very quickly, which is why you never really saw the club much past, you know, the late 80s, I suppose. It was just, or the late 90s. It was just one of those things that just existed solely within that decade, and then it was gone very, very quickly. People just started to remember it. But like I said, yeah, it was wild. A few days ago, I was in a Walgreens parking lot, and I was just getting out of my car, and I looked, and I just saw this club on somebody's car. The first time I had seen that thing in so long. It was really wild. I had to take a picture of it. I was afraid that the people who maybe owned the car were there, and they saw me taking a picture of their car. But, you know, the crazy thing is, I almost didn't immediately see it, because it was not a bright red color. It was a club that was perhaps spray painted, although maybe the company who makes the club, in order to, you know, combat all the criticism that it wasn't a very safe thing only because of its color, you know, because that like bright red color, like the Coca-Cola color, as soon as you saw that trademarked red color, you would think that it was like a you would immediately think it was a club and you would just steal it. But it had been like painted brown or camouflage. It was more of like a camouflage color. So I think that that's what they were hoping. But then that would defeat like another reason of the club, which is to like not have the thief break into your car at all. Like, if the thief breaks into your car and then they see like, oh my God, I didn't see that they had a club. Oh, well, just go move on. You know, you still got shattered glass all over the concrete of the parking lot. So whatever. Yeah. But this freaking thing, I was, so astonished by it. That I'd seen it, that they still make these things, or maybe they don't make them anymore, and it was just something that's like worked for this person for the last 35 years. They're like, I don't understand it. Like, it works fine for me, this club, right? I mean, they were not necessarily driving like a Mercedes, right? Like, they weren't really driving like a Tesla, one of those cars that I think the criminals would want to steal. They were just, so I think it's more like just, you know, if you wanted to get a car that was like thief proof, then just get like a piece of shit. Like a right? I don't know. I think that's what it was. Yeah. But yeah, man, this thing. Let's see if I can find like an old commercial for the club. 'Cause I do remember just watching television and in like maybe middle school and just seeing endless infomercials for this thing telling you to buy the club. And yeah, of course there's like a ton of you know, YouTube videos showing you how to like beat the club, defeat it, right? Get more specific with my search. The club security device, 1990s commercial. There's like a lot of confirmation bias in YouTube searches. You know, the initial thing you type in doesn't yield your results, so you just keep on typing in words until it gives you something you want. Eventually you'll find something, or AI will make it up on the spot. Yeah, here's one right here. This is I don't know what year this is from, but it looks very 90s. The club anti-car theft device TV commercial.
Hold it. I say we can beat those thieves with the club.
A club, officer?
The club.
It's the anti-theft device policemen use in their own cars.
Why the club?
It's easy to use, it's tough to defeat, and it's highly visible.
Is the club better than electronic alarms?
Better.
Is the club better than cuff devices?
Better.
Is the club better than cane-like wheel and pedal locks?
Much better.
Listen to former police lieutenant Ron Carnevale.
I've never seen a more effective deterrent to auto theft. Anyone that wants to keep their car should get the club.
Choose the anti-theft device policemen use in their own car. The club.
Available at Sears. So you can buy them at Sears. That is that was fantastic. Oh my God, what a commercial. Don't take it from us. Take it from Lieutenant Ron Carnevale, head of LAPD Auto Squad for 7 years. They show, like, it's like an oil painting. Like, the ones that, like, former presidents get of themselves to, like, hang in the White House. They don't show, like, an actual video interview with this guy. They just show an oil painting, and then they have, like, a voiceover. So how do you know if it's actually him? This is weird.
I've never seen a more effective deterrent to auto theft. Anyone that wants to keep their car should get the club.
Choose the anti-theft.
So, yeah, they're selling this thing like it's, these are the three reasons to get it. It's easy to use, it's tough to defeat, and it's highly visible. So, I don't know if you've ever seen, like, an escape from prison movie, like Escape from Alcatraz, but, you know, generally to a thief, when they see, like, maxims or they see certain security features, they immediately just go about, like, how do I defeat that? All I need is just, like, time and a plan to defeat that. So the fact that it's, like, highly visible automatically is just working against the club's favor, because it's like, okay, now I know which cars I'm going to break into because I know exactly how to defeat this club. And in this case, it was, like, very simple. And, yeah, I think, like, the fatal flaw of the club is they clearly designed it with just not consulting actual criminals and not really product testing it at all. They just thought that, like, yeah, this thing, you know, it's like it's red and it's kind of like it's got like a bifurcated end. So that's where it wedges against one end of the steering wheel and then it stretches out and there's like an extended, you know, thing that like a little bar that latches onto the other end of the wheel. And, you know, and it's just one of these commercials. This is like, you know, stop thief. We're real tough on crimes, you know. And the thief, of course, looks like just, I don't know, he looks like Mike Ditka in a Paul Bear Bryant houndstooth hat. That's their version of the car thief. Yeah, here's another club commercial from 1994. Let's see what they're saying here about the club.
20 seconds. Police need your help. I'm Deputy Flack, and please, wherever you park your car, lock the club on the steering wheel to prevent your car from being stolen. The club is a tempered steel lock that's tough to defeat. Its high visibility deters thieves and makes them move to an easier target. The club is the best auto theft deterrent I've seen, and I recommend you use it. Accept no cheap imitations. Always ask for the club by name. And let's put auto thieves in their place.
In jail overnight so that they'll get released on $200 bond. Right? Yeah, like in the 90s, auto thieves were really not on the radar of the criminal justice system all that much. You know, unless they were super predators, right? Yeah. Let's see if I can find that scene from Swingers, the club. With I think that's Heather Graham and Jon Favreau, right? You think I could find that very specific scene from the movie Swingers? Probably not. Again, let's like do a little bit of modifying the search. So we'll do like Swingers. When did that movie come out? Like 1996. I don't know why I saw that movie in high school. It was like, I wasn't into swing dancing, but I don't know. It was one of those movies that was just always very present on the video store shelf. It was very kind of iconic box. Swingers 1996. I'm going to say type in Heather Graham. She's very cute in that movie, Heather Graham. Yeah, here's a scene of them like dancing to Go Daddy Go.
Dude, check it out, dude. I swear to God, it's fucking on. Look at him.
Dude, it's right, so it's fucking on, dude.
I know, it's on.
Give it up for Mike. Dude, it's fucking on, dude.
Okay, it's on, dude.
It's on.
Jesus
to you.
Christ. I'm sorry.
It's a phone call.
It's like Vince Vaughn is trying to get his best friend, Jon Favreau, into a relationship of some kind, and Jon Favreau meets Heather Graham. And they're dancing to Big Bad Voodoo Daddy. Here's a comment on here. Trent really cared about Mike getting a girl more than himself scoring. Real mates. Oh, here it is. Here's the song.
Go, Daddy, oh. Go, Daddy, oh. Go, Daddy, oh.
Starting to get the hang of it. Starting to get into that swing. You know, I get why they call it swing, because it's like when you're on the swings, you know, like when you're a kid on the playground, it's like a slow kind of getting started. You got to get yourself into a rhythm and, ooh, and then you go and you do... You're not, you do kind of tricks, you spin around a little bit.
Yeah.
I wonder where that's where they get the name swing. Okay, enough of this. I want to see the club. I'm not interested in swing music. I just want to see like 90s security devices. And of course they don't have it. Of course it's just the boring swing scene where they swing dance. Oh, that's BS. Yeah, there's like no scenes of them. Oh, wait, no, I think I found it. Oh, my God. Okay, they're on the street. Okay.
Did you know that if you fold both sides of a paper inwards, draw over the seams, and repeat the folding and drawing over the other...
No, I didn't know that. Did you know about the club? Okay. Now, wait a second. No, this is just a scene where they're talking. I need the scene where she gets in the car and, like, looks at the club.
It's getting kind of late, so he's probably...
Do you want me to drive you to your car?
No, that's not... I'm right... That's my hog right there. I'm across the street.
Yeah, this is before they get... Okay, well, I'm done with that, and, you know. I'm not interested in that anymore. I remember, early 2000s, I had, like, a friend who was in my sketch comedy group, who had moved down to Birmingham from Knoxville, and he was really into swing music. And I think he may have been the last person alive who was into swing music, and I think he was desperately trying to bring it into the 2000s. Like, we went to the Five Points Music Hall, and he would go up, there was a jukebox there, and he put on, I don't know, something from like the Squirrel Nut Zippers or Brian Setzer Orchestra or whatever. And he had a friend down there, another guy who was visiting him, just like his best friend from college or something. And nobody else would dance swing with either one of them. So I just remember they were like swing dancing together. It's like two 100% heterosexual guys just swing dancing with each other. It was like one of those great memories that I have from that early time period, that weird 2000 to 2003 transfer from the 90s to the 2000s. And Curry was always into Swingers and Swing Kids and always used to tell us that he was going to single-handedly bring swing music back. You know. Yeah, I guess that's a document, right? Those are two very exclusive things of the artifacts of the 1990s, right? You know, the club and swing music, you know. Swing music, of course, was a revival. You know, it had existed in the 1940s, unlike the club, I suppose. Like, you would go to the swing club to swing dance, but you would not use it to lock your car. I don't know. Although I think like you could use the club today. I mean, you know, that's why I was surprised that I saw it in like a Walgreens parking lot, because it really should have been in like a museum, right? It should have been in a museum, you know, on the steering wheels of all like the old cars for like World War II or something like that. I don't know. Yeah. Yeah. So, speaking of, you know, being in a museum, I don't know. It's a fairly rainy night here, and this is the Midnight Citizen Show. I'm your host, Mike Booty. Welcome to the show. I'm not in the Midnight Citizen studio tonight. I'm in the Midnight Citizen garage, and more specifically, I'm in the Midnight Citizen's parents' garage. I'm here on a Friday night, and was going to sit out on the porch, but it has been storming just like incessantly all night long. Crazy, violent King Lear Shakespeare kind of storms, right? Yeah. I'm here like officially, I suppose, unemployed. Although I still have some papers left to grade. But yeah, I did get my last paycheck from teaching college a few days ago. And now I'm just now that I have that money, I'm still I guess technically employed, because I've still got work to do. Like, all my final students' grades are due on Monday, so I got to do those. You know, I was trying to get them done earlier this week. My students turned them all in on Tuesday. I was trying to get them done like before Thursday when I got my final paycheck. Because I really didn't want to get my final paycheck and then still have to do like all this work after I got it, knowing that I'm not going to get another paycheck, but that I'm basically unemployed and at this point now working for free, kind of, right? But whatever, it is what it is, right? You know. Yeah, so I am now officially unemployed. I have, like, no steady paychecks ahead of me for now, right? No, I did not move back home. I did not move back in with my parents. There's several more steps of grace that I have to fall from before I do that, right? Yeah, it's just this thing where tomorrow morning my little sister is actually graduating from her master's program in education. She went through the same program that I did about, you know, I think I graduated now 13 years ago from that master's in education program. So, yeah, she started out as a marketer, working for like you know, marketing companies and copywriting and editing and, you know, photo arranging and all that stuff, and then just got into teaching and found that she had a knack for it, that she really liked it, and she's actually been teaching longer than I have now at this point. She started teaching at a private Christian school, I think a couple of years before I got my job teaching high school. And now she teaches middle school, and the middle school, it's a public school, so they required that she had to get licensed and she had to get a degree in education. And so for the last couple of years now, she's been going back to a school, not the same school, not the same university I went through, but one that's, you know, out in the country a little bit, north of, or I guess south of Birmingham. So, and finished the program, finished it like very, very good, very well with honors. And is graduating tomorrow, but the ceremony is like at 9:30 in the morning, something like that. So I kind of had an option. I could, stay at my apartment tonight in the city and wake up super early and drive out there in the morning, or I could just come out to my parents' house, stay here tonight, and that's what I chose to do. And also, it's just raining, and it's nice to just sit in the garage and just look out at the rain. It's kind of nice to do that. My parents technically have a covered porch. They have like a porch that's extends from the kitchen and like a little sunroom, but it's not covered, but it does cover the floor, or the deck does cover a little pavemented area under it, but because of all the cracks in the wood, it if you sit out there on like a rainy night, you still get rained on. So just not as much as if you were sitting on the top. So I'm here in the garage instead. It's just like a nice compromise. So, it's graduation season, and this time last year I went through my own graduation. Can't believe it's already been a year there. Yeah, a year ago I graduated. I got my master's in English literature this time around. And just like continuing that philosophy of just always going back to school and doing your best not to pay for it. This time around I went through and got my master's and was able to like fund it based on basically just adjuncting for the department that I was teaching in. It's like I had teaching experience and I just like taught English composition to freshmen. And then when I graduated last year, it was just one of those things where it's like I didn't have a job really lined up afterwards. And so I just stayed on with the university, and that's what I've been doing for the last year. It's just adjuncting. And back in the fall, I went and adjuncted, taught a couple of classes over at the community college, and was going to continue doing that this spring, but they had me enrolled to teach a class, and then that class under-enrolled. So I did not teach at the community college, so I've just been teaching at the university. So, that's where I am right now, is that I've got classes set up to teach in the fall at the university, and I'm also pretty much guaranteed to go and teach classes at the community college as well in the fall. But just at this point, like, adjuncting is just so unstable. Like, I enjoy teaching college. I really do. I love, I've talked about this in the past, it's just like a great job. You're very autonomous in the way that you teach. It's just really not unlike any other job I've ever taught. It's so strange, where you basically are just going in and you're just, making your lesson plans. You're going in, you're implementing them, and you're grading papers. And, in the past year, I've only seen my boss formally once. I've seen her twice, but one of those times I just bumped into her in the break room. So it's just the weirdest job, where you're working for this gigantic institution and nobody really knows you're there. And I've enjoyed that. It's kind of been nice being a bit of a ghost. Could we say like a ghost in the machine? Is that what that definition means? I don't know, but it does feel, it's like, just a big university machine and you're just like in it, and an incredibly anonymous cog. And I know some people would not like that at all. Like, when I get a job, I want to stand out so I can get promoted and get a raise, and I can be the one who goes from being told what to do to being the one who tells people what to do. But I've worked in the jobs like that and I've been fine in them, but I just wanted to be like a little bit anonymous for a while. And yeah, for like the last 3 years, I've just been, that's what I've been. I've been like a, you know, autonomous and anonymous. Anonymous and autonomous, right? Being able to essentially just dictate the directions of my days. And I enjoyed that quite a lot. And, I wouldn't say that my enjoyment of that is coming to an end. I could 100% do this kind of thing for the rest of my life, right? Like, just have this kind of job where I just go in, I have very little supervision, and I do my job to my own standards, which are very high, but I'm not just, like, constantly being subjected to somebody else's opinion, like, to a superior's opinion of me, and, you know what I mean? It's been a great feeling just to go from, you know, a job where I did have a boss and, you know, teaching high school. And if the students did not do very well, then it wasn't really looked at as their failing. It was looked at as mine for not teaching them well enough and not guiding them. And the administrator would come down on me, and the guidance counselor would come down on me, and the parents would come down on me. And then the student would also be pissed off that they didn't do better because of me. And it was such an irrational kind of world that I was living in, because in my mind I was doing everything that I could, you know, for all the students that I taught. But I was constantly just being scrutinized for my teaching abilities. And it was just, I mean, don't get me wrong, it was like the school that I taught in was a very nurturing environment. It was good, and I liked, you know, the people that I worked with. But, you know, you're teaching, you know, 8 hours a day for, you know, 9 months out of the year, just constantly being under the threat of scrutiny and criticism and unfair assessments so much of the time. That it took a lot of the joy out of actually, you know, teaching. And, but I still knew I wanted to teach. So just being able to, like, be in the college in academia for the last 3 years has been very, you know, very uplifting, very rewarding. And I've enjoyed it a lot. And the students have been for the most part really great. And the thing about it is like, if the students are not doing very well, then you are the one diagnosing that. You are the one assessing them. You're the one modifying your lesson plans and your teaching strategies to help them. And there's not all these other, like, cooks in the kitchen that are just coming up with all these plans that you need to do. Like, you're just the one you're the singular one who's doing it. And at the kid, it just comes down to the point where the student is just not getting it, and they're just not trying to get it, and they're just you know, borderline just being lazy. And then that's them. And, like, the administration, like my boss and my supervisors at college, they totally say, like, that's them. You did what you could, just, you know, move on, you're fine. Right. And it's not looked at whatsoever as you're failing. And yeah, this does create the, you know, possibility for some kind of, like, I don't want to say corruption, but I definitely just the college professor who just becomes lazy and complacent because they have such a low amount of accountability in their teaching. It definitely creates that. But I will say that that's not me. And, you know, I almost feel like I'm interviewing for a job right now. It's like, I'm not, like, you know, because that's what I've been doing for, like, the last few weeks right now, you know? Yeah. Because as I said, like, I am getting to the point where, as much as I love just this autonomy that I have and just, like, as anonymous as I have been, it's just not a stable lifestyle, and it also is unfulfilling ultimately at the end of the day, right? Because, you know, logistically, and I suppose logically, there's no real future in it. There's no real future in just adjuncting, because you're never going to get a salary. You're never going to get benefits. And you're also just, like, to be honest, never going to get the respect, ultimately, of, like, your colleagues in the English department who are professors and tenured professors and, you know, these people who are, like, full-time folks who, you know, are doing all the things that you went through the program to do. Like, and, you know, the feeling that you get is that these are the people, the English professors who have, like, taught you and mentored you and weaned you to the point where you have graduated the program. They do not want to see you continue to just come back into the program and teach freshman English and composition. They just don't want to see that. They want to see you get out into the world and actually do something with those freaking skills that they, you know, that they taught you. Right. And yeah, just like, that's where I am right now is like, I feel like I need to do something like that. So, you know, as I said, there's a couple of different options. There's like, I could go to the next level, right, of my education. I could get like a PhD. That's a long shot for me right now because PhDs, that's like another 5 years in college. And then you would, you know, go on to the job market, marketing your skills as a college professor. Just the, not to say that like the market all out there, the job market for college professors in the humanities is already tough because of, the way that the current administration, you know, the government of the United States of America is treating the humanities departments, with not a lot of respect, and is actively actually trying to gut them. I don't know what it's going to be like in 5 years. I just don't. But there's also just like this element of like, I may not want to teach college for the rest of my life, and I may not want to be like that, you know, like academic, not to stereotype, but you know, that, you know, old academic who's just in the classroom and, you know, theorizes about the world and, doesn't really affect any real change within it. And I don't know, at the same time, I kind of like being that guy who doesn't affect any change, just like that passive intellectual to a degree. And, I mean, not to say like there are activist intellectuals, but, you know, I don't know. But yeah, a great deal of what I've been doing for the last, you know, 2 years or so while I've been in graduate school and then finishing graduate school and teaching is supplementing my income with, you know, delivering food and driving around doing various side hustles and all that. And at this point right now, that is my primary source of income. That's, you know, I've got like a couple of freelance gigs that are in the fire right now. But generally, like, that's what I am doing right now. That's my primary source of income, is just getting in the car, driving around all day long. And as I've been doing this, in between driving, just like parking in parking lots, or these days because it's like the beginning of the summer and it's really hot outside, you know, sitting in air-conditioned coffee shops like Dunkin' Donuts and just reading my novels, like reading my Thomas Pynchon novels and things like that, and looking out the window at just like the world and just being like, I guess like I just this is what I am right now. It's like I'm this person and I've got this, I suppose if you were to tally it up, I've got like a brain that's worth about like $80,000, I suppose. And you know, I'm delivering Chipotle to, you know, the working people of this town. And it just stirs an image of my mind that I'm, at one point is kind of cool if you look at it from like a repo man, perspective, or just think about the fact that like the really genius people in this world are the people who are driving taxi cabs. You know, like, they're the intellectuals. They're the ones who really know what's going on in the world because they see it through the windshields every day of the of their cars. You know, they know what's going on. There's this again, that's like the passive intellectual. They may not be teaching college, but they are nevertheless doing a job where it's like they've got all these ideas and theories in their heads, but they're not really in a position to act on them, to do anything about them, right? All they can do is just like let them fester and grow inside their head and, you know, water those ideas with like occasional books and, you know, podcasts and things like that. And I keep on saying to myself, like, I've got all this education and now I'm just not teaching anymore. And it's like, this is what I'm doing. Is like, this is what I want to be doing with my education. And I get a little bit sad and depressed and I feel some despair about that. You know what I mean? And it just reminded me of years ago, you know, before like Uber and before Lyft and all these other side hustles where you could get in your car and you could make a living more or less driving around all day in your car. I had signed up to drive a taxi. You know, I had turned 25 years old. I think I was about 26 and I was working at Starbucks and I just really wanted to just be in my car driving around working all day rather than just like in this stationary position serving people lattes out of a drive-through window. And I called the local cab company and they said, yeah, come on in, we always need drivers, right? So I went in and I signed up and I had to drive around a couple of days and train with a veteran driver. And I got in and this veteran driver, he like, in order to get in the passenger seat, he had to move all of these like books out of the way. And they were like the classic novels of the 20th century. They were like the Thomas Pynchons and the Philip Roth books, right? And just getting all these books out of the way. And this guy, he was like a, you know, he was a very much a, I don't know, what do you want to call it? Like a stick shift intellectual or, you know, like an, like a mobile roving intellectual, you know, thinker guy, just a guy who had like such a brilliant brain. And it was one of the best 2 days I'd ever spent in the, in a car with somebody, just driving around the city, talking about books and movies and just, you know, grand theories about the world and what in the world is going on. And, It was really just like a great education for a couple of days. And when it was over, I was really sad because now it's like I had my training and, I could get in the car, I could get in the cab and I just drove it around but I didn't have him to talk with, you know, and now I was like, you know, graduated to like the, whatever you want to call it, stick shift intellectual position of, and I had my car there with me. I had my cab and I had my books. I don't remember what books I was reading at the time, but it was probably something in the vein of like Philip Roth and, you know, Kurt Vonnegut and all those books you read like when you're in your mid 20s and just in need of some kind of like some kind of like enigma to create for yourself, you know, and just like driving around in the hot summer and just thinking about all these things and just theorizing and being a little conspiratorial, you know, as you're picking up people from the VA and driving them to their homes in the sticks. Right. And, you know, all these years later, it's like that's where I am. It's like, I that was, God, 16 years ago. I'm still doing the same thing. And at this point, you know, there's a little bit of anxiety over that. It's like, is that who I'm meant to be? Is that who I'm meant to be? Like, after all of this, after all of this education, right? I've got a bachelor's degree. I've got two master's degrees. I've got, like, you know, 10 years of professional experience. But I'm still doing this all the time. Just driving around and reading books and just, like, thinking about the world. You know? Is this ultimately what I'm meant to do? It may be, but right now it cannot be. I mean, I have to get out there and, you know, make a living somehow and find a purpose for myself. You know, I think that that's what it, that that's ultimately, that's like what it is. It's like finding a purpose. Because like when I'm teaching, when I'm in a classroom, I'm feeling so comfortable. You know, I have a purpose. It's really only, and the same was true in college, in high school as it is in college. You know, I was so happy when I was teaching high school, whenever I was actually just teaching, the act of being in front of students and working with them and splitting them up into group work and seeing how they're doing with the assignment. And if they're not doing so well, then tweaking the assignment for later classes. You know, there's a great joy in that. And it was only really between the classes when there would be problems. Right? When you would get like that angry email from the parent at 9 o'clock at night with all the words misspelled and stepped over because they were clearly drinking wine when they were sending it to me and typing it up, right? Oh. Yeah, and like last week when I was like teaching my last class, I almost like, I didn't even see it coming, I think, because I had been in such a state of denial for a couple of days, maybe even a couple of weeks before that, that I wasn't even thinking about the fact that like, oh my God, I'm about to be like, this is like, I'm about to be unemployed and I'm about to no longer teach anymore, you know, because I derived such satisfaction out of just like teaching college and being in the classroom and teaching. And I had such confidence with it, whatever was going on. As soon as like the class started and I was in front of the students, it just, everything was like so zen-like. It was just a, you know, it's like, this is what I'm really meant to do. Right. It's the same feeling of like being in the car and just driving around. And, right, like just having that paperback book folded up and just sitting on your dash, you know, just like reflecting in the windshield. You're driving down the street and you can't wait to just get that book open and just learn some more about the world, you know. And I know that sounds very pretentious, but that's like what it is. Just these, there's these moments of comfort that you feel when you know this is exactly what you're supposed to be doing in the world, right? And I get that feeling a lot when I'm standing in front of students. And then like last Thursday at 11 o'clock, my class started and I realized this is the last class I'm like ever, you know, I'm like, I've got classes slated for the fall, but like, I don't know how much longer I can adjunct. It's just so unstable. I've really got to find a permanent job. And there's really no permanent jobs right now in college unless I get a PhD. So Jesus, this may be it. And I wasn't even teaching that day. I was like, my students were doing presentations. They were getting up there and they were doing these presentations, presenting their work that they have done all semester long. And, you know, it was like, oh my God. Like, I'm just sitting there watching my students do these presentations and getting up between each one and going up to the computer so that I could, like, you know, call up the next student and flip to their PowerPoint. And at one point I said to my students, like, you know, I may hold you guys in here for as long as I want to because I'm afraid to leave. I don't want to leave right now. Like, I may keep you guys here until I'm ready to go, if that's okay with you. But, you know, then I stopped and I, you know, kind of quipped. I said, no, I think it's illegal for me to hold you guys against your will. I don't think that's right. But, and they all laughed. Haha. You know. Yeah. And it's just, and then it was over and it was like, now here it is. It's like a week and a half later. And right. You know, it's just, you know, I need some purpose, right?
Need it back.
And I'm looking for it, right? Like, I still feel pretty good. And maybe one of the reasons why I've been holding off grading my students' papers is because I just don't really want to let that go, maybe. I want to kind of keep the feeling of just being useful, right, in a way. You know, and the past week has been good because I've been getting emails from some students just saying, like, I want to thank you for the semester. I've really learned a lot. And, you know, you know, it's normal to get those emails from students. But this year, this semester, it definitely feels like a little bit more like important, I guess, than it's felt in years past. Because it may very well be I really do not know when I'm going to teach again. And it may be in the fall if I don't get a job or, I don't know. But, you know, the job hunt, and I've been talking about it the last few podcasts over the past month or so, has been just like as it always is, just like a series of ups and downs, and sometimes the ups outnumber the downs, but not in Nottingham. You know, lately it's just been, I don't know, up in the air. You know, it's like I had an interview over Zoom, and I had an interview in person, and then I had another interview over Zoom. The Zoom interviews, they were like screening interviews, and the in-person interview was like, just to be honest with you, the in-person interview was like, I thought I had the job when I went in for it, right? So yeah, the first interview I had that was like over Zoom, I felt like I bombed the interview. I felt like I gave like vague answers. I didn't really do a good job. And was pretty certain after that interview was over that I had, I didn't get it, you know. And, they told me it would be like a couple weeks before they let me know anything. And a couple weeks, that was like last week, and I didn't hear anything from them again. So like, you know, during that whole week. So I just assumed, I've been assuming this entire week that I didn't get it. And then a few days later, I get like an email from my boss, at the university, and she says like there's this outreach program at the university that's looking for adjunct instructors to help teach some high school students at a summer camp at the university this summer, and they're just looking for some adjunct instructors to come in and work with them. So it happened to be like a couple of weeks this summer when I'm free, which I'm free a lot this summer, but you know, I'm also teaching like a summer camp, so I've got that going. I teach a summer camp, a theater summer camp. Like, I just teach some kids in playwriting like every June. I've been doing that for about 10 years now. But yeah, right after that, though, would be this other summer camp at the university. So the scheduling works out pretty well. And so I reached out to them, and they emailed me back pretty quickly, and they just said, you know, can you come in and talk to us about it? I said, yeah, like I assumed that I had the job because I sent in my resume and they were looking for adjunct English instructors, and that's me. And I went in, and it was a kind of strange because I went into the interview and just like sat down waiting for them. And they kind of kept on coming out every 5 minutes, just saying, sorry, it's just going to be a few more minutes. We're just, you know, finishing up. And okay, so I went in and met with them, not even really knowing that it was a job interview, genuinely thinking, I guess I know it sounds like arrogant, but they also just didn't frame it as if it was an interview. And they just wanted to come in, and they were like collaborating with me. They were talking to me. It's like, can you teach this? Like, we're interested in giving you a class in theater. We're interested in, like, you know, would you be able to teach like a class in content creation and working with the kids and like creating things for social media. And I felt like the interview went really well. I was giving them like good answers and everything, and they seemed to really like me, and it felt like they were just more like collaborating more than anything else. And like I said, during the whole thing, I guess I just assumed that I went in there like already having it. I genuinely did not think it was a job interview. I thought it was just like, I'm going in there and just meeting with them about the schedule and talking about like certain things that they need me to teach. Right. So I leave that interview, and then like a few days later get an email that says like, sorry, we found somebody who has better qualifications than you or better qualifications, or they found a candidate who meets the standards that we're looking for at this time. I don't know, some kind of language like that. So I was like, okay. It didn't bother me so much, but it also, like, what really was confusing to me was, like, they were looking for just somebody to work with who was coming in there. They needed somebody to come in there just for 2 weeks, for, like, 2 hours in the afternoon in June. just to work with high school students. And that's a big job. I know it sounds like a big job, but it's, like, that's one of those things that I have experience doing. And But I just figure that the reason I did not get that job is because I started off the interview telling them that, you know, I said, I know you're looking for somebody for 2 weeks, but I right now I'm looking for something permanent, and I am interviewing at other jobs. So, like, if I do get a permanent job, I won't be able to work with your camp. And if I hear anything, I'll be sure to immediately let you know that. And I think they were really appreciative of that. So I think, like, that's why I probably didn't get it, because somebody else came in who is not looking for another job right now and is fully available, and there's no chance that they could drop out. So that's why I figured that I didn't get the job, most likely. Yeah. But yeah, then a couple days go by, and I get, like, an email invitation to another Zoom interview for another organization and meet with them. And that goes very well. They're supposed to let me know if they're going to invite me to the second round of interviews next week. And while I'm right after I get rejected from that one job and, you know, interview for the other, I get an email, I think it's yesterday, from the first job that I interviewed over Zoom with, to my complete surprise, inviting me to a second interview next week. So, you know, it's just like ups and downs. You know, you get an interview, you get interviews, you lose a job, you get invited to the next round. It's just like, you know, all in all. And the wild thing is like, none of this is at all coming through LinkedIn. None of it's coming through Indeed, you know, ZipRecruiter, like, just none of these, like, websites that I'm on that purport to be able to be the most efficient, you know, job hunting services, you know, out there, like, none of them are helping me get a job right now. I got, you know, one invitation from, like, ZipRecruiter that just kept on coming to me. That said, like, we need, hey, you know, we need, we see you have experience teaching. We need somebody to come with, like, work with disabled veterans, teaching them how to play golf and reading Bible stories to them. Like, I'm not kidding you. I got, like, 3 invitations to this one-on-one. It was like, what have I ever, what on my resume says that I play golf, you know, read the Bible? I don't know. It's like the one interview that just, like, keeps pestering me to, like, respond to them. And yeah, just, like, everything else is just, you know, I'll go on LinkedIn and I'll apply to these jobs that I feel like I'm a good candidate for. But, like, you see that, like, 100 people have already applied for it. It's just, like, a completely useless service. Wildly useless. I have no use for LinkedIn whatsoever. Yeah. So. So we'll just kind of wait and see, I suppose. I don't know. We'll wait and see. Could probably get a job, like, selling the club door to door. How about that? That sounds good. I don't know. Thank you so much for joining me here tonight. Midnight Citizen Show. I know this is a, you know, not the normal show, usually in the studio, but, like I said, like, you know, this has been a wild week. I would have graded papers earlier this week, but, as I'll probably talk about, like, in future episodes when we're kind of out of the woods a little bit, wife Jessica's mom, my mother-in-law, was visiting my parents, you know, the you know, at the house where I'm staying right now. There's her car in the driveway. You know, last weekend, and she just took a nasty fall, and she was in the hospital for several days. So my wife and I have just been in the hospital trading places and being there at the same time with her over the past several days. And finally today, or yesterday, she got moved to a rehab facility where she's going to be for the next several weeks at least. So our lives have been like moderately upended right now in the middle of everything else that's going on. Trying to find a job and, you know, my wife finishing up a show that she's been doing. And so, you know, my life over the last week has just been at the downtown hospital, yo-yoing all over the place there, from the ER to pre-surgery to the room where my mother-in-law eventually ended up, you know, recovering from like a broken femur and all that stuff. So it's just been quite a week, and there's a lot of mysteries about the hospital to uncover that I just haven't quite wrapped my head around yet. For instance, like on the elevator, there was no fourth floor. You know, I know like usually buildings with like more than 14 floors, they usually don't have a 13th floor. I guess it's out of superstition. Like the building, the skyscraper that my dad worked in for years did not have a 13th floor. So I'm used to that. But the one at the hospital, at the university hospital, none of the elevators had four floors. They just went 1, 2, 3, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. And, my wife and I, like, at first it was me, and then my wife kind of joined the fray, trying to figure out why there was no fourth floor. And we, like, asked everybody from every bit of the hierarchy of the hospital. We asked everybody from the doctors. We weren't surprised that the doctors couldn't tell us anything. They couldn't even tell us what was wrong with my mother-in-law in the first place, why she fell. They couldn't tell us that at all. How long it would take to recover, they had no answers for us. So we were not surprised they couldn't answer anything about the fourth floor. But yeah, everybody down to the parking attendants could not answer either, right? And then you would get some smart-ass answers, like from people who had heard this before. Like, well, I don't want to tell you what's on the fourth floor, man. Quite honestly, I'm not even supposed to ask that question myself. They would kind of give us these, like, wink and nod, like, knowing conspiratorial answers. And then they would be like, no, seriously, I don't know. You know, but. So we were trying to figure out what was going on there. My theory is that it's just a floor that is, like, you know, only the staff has access to. It's like the morgue or something like that, even though I think the morgue is always supposed to be like on the bottom floor, but I don't know. Or it could just be like an infrastructural thing where, you know, like there's older buildings that have to match up with the new buildings with the crosswalks and everything. So, you know, I don't know. But I'm going to continue to getting to the bottom of this and talk about it on a future episode. But for now, I just want to say thank you so much for joining me here. And there's a power truck that just came into the cul-de-sac here up the driveway, my parents' house. I guess it's working on the power. Some people are without it right now. So you can join me, find out everything that I do over at mikesbonfire.substack.com. And also over there at the Overnightscape Underground on Sug, onsug.com. I'm over there as well. And over at youtube.com/the_midnightcitizenpodcast. Also over at Instagram under that same moniker, the_midnightcitizenpodcast. And all this will be linked in the show notes. And I look forward to seeing you on the next show. Keep your eyes open.